this is Little Anthony, Little Anthony Imperials, and you're listening to my good friend, Mike Miller, on the Harmony Street Show.
Hi, I'm Rosalind.
And I'm Annette, and we're the original Vandellas. And you're listening to our good friend, Mike Miller,
on the Harmony Street Show.
Hi, this is Joe Billingsley of the Contours, and you're listening to my very good friend, Mike Miller, on the Harmony Street Show.
This version of the Harmony Street Show is brought to you by Sixth Man. They're a fabulous cruise company that puts together theme cruises that are very unique and very, very interesting. Sixth Man has a fabulous cruise coming up. It's the Elvis Cruise. Let's kick off the 35th anniversary year with Elvis fans from around the world on the 5th annual Elvis Cruise. Once in a lifetime, Elvis Experience at Sea will celebrate the King of Rock and Roll in a fun and unique way. Join us immediately following Elvis' birthday celebration in Memphis. Over this holiday weekend aboard the Carnival Fascination, we'll be cruising the Caribbean from Thursday, January 12th through Monday, January 16th, 2012, setting sail from Jacksonville, Florida to the beautiful Nassau and the Bahamas. Providing the entertainment will be some of the best musical talent who have ever performed Elvis music around the globe. Elvis movie co-stars, the world's top Elvis tribute artists, and many of his friends and associates who knew the King best, from panel discussions and concerts to fashion shows and movies. The entire ship is filled with Elvis, the most up-to-date list of entertainers. For all of the details, just go to www.theelviscruise.com. Included will be several theme nights. The 35th anniversary kickoff, the 50s night, Blue Hawaii Luau night, USO formal night. Suites and cabins are still available. So join Sixth Man Cruises for this wonderful Elvis extravaganza. Call us toll free at 1-877-379-9172. Call them toll free at 877-379-9172 or 770-738-6011. See you there. The Elvis Cruise, produced in partnership with Graceland and Sixth Man. Hi, this is Mike Miller, and you're here with me on the Harmony Street Show, and it's my extreme pleasure to have as my guest today on the Harmony Street Show, Mr. Tony McCalley, the lead singer of The Reflections. How you doing, Tony?
I'm doing great. Yeah, I just wish I was down there instead of up here.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something, Tony. It's been about 38 degrees in southern Florida right now. So, you know, we're actually, we're kind of like Detroit the last couple of days.
Yeah, well, you know, we're still in the 20s, though.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, there's that 10 degrees in between.
Yeah.
So, Tony, tell me, you were actually born in the Bronx, right?
Exactly. I was born, I grew up in Pelham Bay area, you know. I was there till I was 11 years old. My dad was a house painter.
Uh-huh.
And my dad used to, when things were bad in New York, he used to fly to Michigan, where his brother, his oldest brother, had he was a painting subcontracting business. And he used to go there and work for him, and, you know, until things got better in New York. And then it got to be more and more that he would leave and go and work in Michigan. And
right.
Then my uncle got a big account in Michigan, a big builder who built, you know, three-bedroom homes,
uh-huh,
kind of thing. And he ended up by asking him to move out there, and we did. I was 11 years old, and, of course, that was a major traumatic thing for me.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me ask you this about the Bronx. Let's stay in the Bronx for a little while. Do you remember much about the Bronx?
Oh, God, yes. I loved it.
Yeah, me too. You know, I was a Bronx kid also. I was actually born in Parkchester, and I lived at 20 Metropolitan Oval, right down from the Oval Drugs, off of, you know, the main drag there. And believe it or not, Shari Lewis was my babysitter.
Oh, wow.
For me and my brother.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Her mother was Miss Hurwitz, the music teacher at PS 106.
Oh, wow. I went to PS 71.
Right. Well, I know 71 very well. As a matter of fact, something that we didn't talk about, both of my daughters went to 71.
No kidding.
Yes. And, you know, when they went there, learning Italian was mandatory.
I bet.
Yeah, they actually made them learn Italian in elementary school.
Isn't that? I wish they would have taught it when I was there. You know, the only way I heard it is at home. And, of course, my grandmother and grandfather spoke fluent Italian. My mother understood it and spoke it. But, you know, as we moved away from that culture, you know, coming out to Michigan,
right?
I lost it. I just, you know, I can get a few words here and there, but that's about it. You know?
Yeah, no, I understand.
I love the Bronx. I mean, I still love the Bronx.
I hear you. And so much talent came out of the Bronx. And we could go on and on listing groups that came out of the Bronx, you know, the foremost being Dion and the Belmonts, and, you know, it's a wonderful thing. All the boroughs, you know.
Yeah, Dion and the Belmonts, that was my inspiration. I wanted to be another Dion when I was a kid because I thought he had it locked up. He had a real great voice that the girls liked, and his background singers were just tremendous.
Well, you know, and of course we lost Freddie Milano just recently as every time you go on the net or pick up the newspaper or answer the phone, it's another one of us and or our peers being taken away, and that's why we need to cherish every day.
Oh, you better believe it. I mean, we work with so many people that are no longer here that I cherish the thought, the nights that we perform with these people. Just, I mean, it was just something you can't get back. You know, the wonderful thing about remembering those people when they were younger and having a ball, you know, doing shows with them, and then realize, you know, we're all getting older, and the light may go out.
I understand.
You just don't know what's around the corner and whether you'll see these people anymore. So we always have a ball when we're with them.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the audiences are diminishing, too. But it is getting to the point, like, you know, when I'm doing a show, sometimes they look out there, and the baby boomer audience, sometimes I call them the oil painting.
Yeah.
Because they're locked in, they don't move, you never really know what they're thinking.
Yeah.
There's a woman really enjoying you in the front row and her husband's asleep with his head on her shoulder. And I call it the oil painting, and I would say sometimes, would somebody get up or do some jumping jacks or something? Because you look like an oil painting out there. And then they come alive and they, you know.
It's true, and I've noticed, I'll be honest with you, we've noticed in our crowds, and our shows that we're getting a lot of young people that will come up to us later and say, gee, we just love your group.
Oh, yeah.
Never expected to hear that come out of old guys.
Yeah, no, I hear you, you know, and I do understand that. So tell me, what are some of your memories of the Bronx?
Well, you know, you talk about Parkchester. We
right.
Looked at Louis.
Well, you know, fabulous theater, and, you know, that was on Castle Hill Avenue.
Yep, that's where we used to go. In fact, I used to take the train. We used to take the subway, and we were young kids then.
Right.
Know, seven, 8 years old. We'd be going with our older cousins.
Right.
Joe, the matinees, and we'd go there, get in the train, and I remember there was, I believe, Middletown Road, then Zariga Avenue.
Right.
All these streets going towards Parkchester. We'd get off Parkchester, and we'd walk to the theater and stand in line, get in, and spend the day there.
Oh, I hear you. They had a great Italian bakery down the block called Lambiese's, and they used to have ices. They were Italian ices par excellence, and I've discussed this with people about some of the real fine points of the Bronx and Parkchester.
Definitely.
And there were certain things that you just couldn't replace because, you know, I loved it, and I actually came back as an adult and wound up teaching at Castle Hill Junior High School, which was, you know, right in Parkchester. And so I left, and for some reason the universe had it that I would come back. So, and it had changed a lot, of course.
Yeah, I go back every once in a while. I've seen a lot about my family that lived in New York. Quite a few of them moved to Fort Lauderdale.
Uh-huh.
They live in Fort Lauderdale, but there are still some that live there, and they live in Pearl River, Orange County area. So I get a chance to go back. Well, I got a cousin that lives in Eastchester.
Right. Oh, East Chester has a great Chinese restaurant in East Chester. You know, as a matter of fact,
you're like me. You know all these great places.
The food places. The food places. Those were great memories, and memories of New York will never go away.
No, you know what the fun part about it is? When I lived in New York, I used to be in the Fife Drum and Bugle Corps of PS-71.
Okay.
Okay, so I used to play a bugle.
Right.
So every morning, or not morning as much as every afternoon when we'd come home from school, I'd be playing a bugle.
Wow.
My grandmother, because my mother and father both worked,
uh-huh.
My grandmother would always know when I'd be coming home. The whole neighborhood would, because
wow.
I'd be playing this bugle all the time. And what happened was I became pretty good on the bugle to the point where I became a sergeant.
Wow.
And we had two other buglers in my little part of the band.
Right.
Like three bugles and
uh-huh.
I don't know how many fifes and drums and
right.
so forth. Well, the fun part about that was I was picked by the Boy Scouts of America to be the bugler of the year.
Wow.
And I was young. I was only, you know, I'm going to say maybe 10.
Why not?
Right? So we go all the way out to the Catskill Mountains, right?
Oh, good.
Where they had the you got to hear this.
I did a lot of work there.
And I think this is beautiful, right? I uh-huh. can't wait to get out there, and I'm going to be playing the bugle for the whole place, right?
Right.
I was picked. Well, needless to say, we get all the way out there, and in the morning I'd get up and I'd play, I'd play Reverie.
Right.
And I'd play Taps at Night.
Right.
So, in the morning, if I didn't get 15, 20 eggs thrown at me every day.
Well, you don't want to be waking those guys up, you know, at 7 in the morning, 6 in the morning.
That was going to happen. Here I couldn't wait to get out there, and I'm getting killed.
Yeah, right. But, you know, see, the whole deal is, you know, if you can play it under pressure, you get
yeah.
to play it even better. You know, like singing under pressure, you know, that's when you really learn it.
Exactly.
You know, yeah, you ever notice that when you rehearse a tune in the living room, it's, you know, you go out and you sing it on stage, but it doesn't really get tight unless you do it under pressure.
Yeah, oh, yeah, you're right.
You know, so
the fun part about it was my background in music in New York was very limited. I never sang in New York.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. I mean, you know, when did you wake up one morning and realize that you could sing?
Well, this is the funny part about it. My dad used to play the accordion and sing Italian songs.
Oh, was that your father? I remember him.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he used to play Italian songs all the time. So I used to listen to him and always had an ability to play by ear.
So you knew the words to Mala Femina. It was probably your first tune.
Well, you know, Way Marie.
There you go.
Way Marie and... what else did I sing? Vagina Mar.
Right.
On and on and on.
Right.
But, you know, the funny part about when I was growing up, I would pick up the accordion and play. So they were going to send me for lessons. Well,
right.
I hated going for lessons because I knew how to play the song.
I hear you.
So pretty soon my teacher said, you know, this is a waste of money.
Right.
He doesn't want to learn how to play the right way. He wants to play his way.
Yeah.
I would suggest you just not pay for it.
Leave me alone. That's bad.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So finally, my parents just gave up on it, you know. And like I said, I was 11 when we moved out to Michigan.
Right.
Never sang, never hummed, never did anything.
No kidding. However, I will tell you one thing. When you play the trumpet, your power and your breath becomes like really fantastic, because every trumpet player I know really had great chops because of their breath control.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I would agree with that, because I did, I used to blast that little bugle that I had. And, of course, you know, it didn't have valves.
Right.
At the time. And, you know, I still got one. I've got one now at home that I take and I play. I wake up my wife.
I hear. You should play it. You should bring it with you and play it on stage once in a while.
Oh, my God.
Just for kicks.
It's funny when I take that thing out. Well, anyway, so when we moved to Detroit,
right.
Michigan, I didn't sing the first, second, I'm going to say maybe I was 11, 12, 13, 14 years old. I'm going to say I started, we were listening to a lot of the music on the air. And a friend of mine, Ed Kaminsky, that I grew up with.
Right.
He was the first friend I met here. He had a collection of R&B records that I had never heard before.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of singers I had never heard before.
What were some of the tunes that he had?
Well, some of them were James Brown. Now, I heard James Brown all the way back when I was 14.
Gotcha.
And I said, I, Sam Cooke and all these.
Right.
I mean, not with the big hits that they had, but I mean, the obscure tunes, the tunes
right.
that you would hear and never heard played on the
So he was a bit of a musicologist then.
Oh
yeah.
Yes. So anyway, we would get together and listen to these guys sing, and I always liked the R&B.
Right. Me too.
Any other type of music. So. One day, it was funny, Eddie and I were just hanging around the house, and we put on an Everly Brothers.
Uh-huh.
I always thought the Everly Brothers had great, great sound because there was only two of them.
Right, that was kind of cool, you know.
Yeah, they had a great sound, but I didn't know what it was called. I didn't know
right.
harmony. I didn't know what harmony was.
Okay.
So anyway, Eddie started singing one of the songs, Wake Up Little Susie.
Right.
His sister's name was Susie.
Right.
All of a sudden, I chimed in, but I started singing the harmony, and I didn't even know how I did that.
Right.
And then we started singing, and I said, you know, boy, that sounds pretty good. We're as good as them, laughingly, you know. And then what happened was...
You probably were.
No, I don't think so.
But just not as well produced.
Yeah, but anyway, we got together a lot of times and started doing Everly Brothers stuff. So
right.
we were singing more and more, and then pretty soon a buddy of ours, this Dennis Damkoff,
uh-huh.
grew up with, one of the guys that was in the neighborhood, he had kind of a deep voice.
Right.
So Dennis would come and he'd sing another part.
Uh-huh.
And the start of the Reflection started with a group called the Parisians.
Uh-huh.
So the Parisians were our first group, and the reason we call them Parisians, one of the guys had wrote a song called Patricia.
Uh-huh.
And we took the name Patricia and said, you know, maybe we'll call ourselves Parisians, you know, uh-huh. like the Paris, living in Paris.
Right. Now, did you guys record?
Well, we did, but, you know, we recorded dubs because
okay.
we would go to these local record, recording studios
right.
here. No labels. No
right.
labels.
Right.
And we get in there and we'd sing and they'd, hey, you guys are great. You know,
right.
you've got nice harmony. And we'd sing these things and we record them.
Now, do you have any of that stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, the one thing we did I have the actual recording,
uh-huh.
The two recordings. One was called Patricia and the other one was called, the other one was called You Didn't Care.
Uh-huh.
And they're both a cappella.
Patricia, Patricia.
Patricia.
Now that was done by the Reflections later,
right?
The '70s,
right?
But we did. I have the original copy of that one.
Is that something that you could send me?
You know, I probably could. Yes, I could.
Yeah, because I
got a lot of scratching on it, though.
Yeah, but so what?
You
mean,
yeah.
Let me tell you, that's the beauty of it, because I have some old recordings. If you heard the original tape recorder recordings of Jimmy Beaumont and the Skyliners, which I have a few of them, it's amazing just to hear them stop and start and tweak the harmony.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jimmy told me, you know, he used to say to me, man, we were terrible at first, man. We worked really hard to get that blend, you know.
I think that's the nature of every, you know, that's the nature of everybody that I've ever talked to in the business that has made it.
Right.
That was part of the sweat and tears that you put into
the
music that we sing.
We did it with Harmony Street, man. I really cracked the whip, and I had them really listening to the blend and really listening to each other.
Oh, yeah.
And then very slowly but surely, we got tighter and tighter and tighter, but we lived with each other. I mean, we were rehearsing like 3 or 4 times a week at the beginning.
Sure. Sure.
You know.
And that's the same with us. We finally, when the group, the Parisians, we did mostly songs with each other, you know, like any place we could, like bathrooms in a.
Oh yeah.
Gas station had great acoustics.
You bet, man. I can't tell you how many times, you know, on Long Island, we'd go to Jones Beach and we'd sing at a group called the Islanders years ago, which we recorded on the Best of Acapella series for Relic Records. And that group, we used to drive around at night and roll the windows down and sing. We'd go to Jones Beach and sing on the blanket. We'd draw like 250 people.
And that's the drive. And remember the old drive-ins, the food drive-ins?
Oh, yeah.
Well, in Michigan, the food drive-ins were like our hangout.
Right.
So we used to take the cars, go up there and meet the girls because, I mean, we'd sit in the car and sing, and pretty soon we'd have all the girls around the car. That was another.
Right. But I want to say something about you. You see, you always had that teen idol hair. So you were destined to be a lead singer in a group because, man, you had the hair.
Oh, boy, did I ever.
You had the hair. Let me tell
you. I look back at days when I was on American Bandstand.
Right.
And I don't know how I had the guts to wear that. I looked at that.
Nah, man, it was. Are you kidding me, man?
I looked at that. I looked back at that and I said, my hair is at least 12 feet high.
Yeah.
I could not believe how high it was.
But it was great, man.
Oh, yeah, it was fun. It was fun.
Yeah.
Well, we were on tour with Fabian, and Fabian and I used to hang around together. We'd be walking down the street, and they knew we were somebody, but they didn't know who.
Yeah, I got you. I know.
Nobody wears hair like that.
No, you know, you're right. So here you are in Detroit. And you're singing with the Parisians. And what happened next?
Well, what happened was at school we had a dance every Friday night, because most schools had dances. And we'd have a Friday night dance that we went to. And that night, the group, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers were there.
Right.
And they were singing kind of with their record, because that's what we did.
Yeah, so you had Jimmy Merchant and Herman Santiago, and what a thrill that is.
Oh, my God. Well, this is the first group we've ever seen live.
Wow.
So I was standing right directly under Frankie Lyman. In fact, I looked at the roof of his mouth as a young kid.
Wow.
And he was singing with his record.
Wow.
And I said, man, look at that. You know, listen. And Eddie was standing next to me, and Dennis was around. And we're all watching these guys and said, man, this is what we got to do. We got to do this. Well, anyway, after that, we started doing whatever we could, you know, see if we could perform someplace. But we were scared. Everybody was afraid to perform in front of anybody.
I hear you.
Other than our families.
Right.
So what happened was we got together and we're asked to sing at a school dance, and it was called the Melody Club.
Gotcha.
And now they gave us a date. Okay, it's going to be in 2 weeks. We got to gear up for this, right?
Yeah.
So here's the four of us looking at each other, saying, "Oh man, we got to do this. Now we got no choice. We have to do it. They're advertising us in school.
Right.
You know, it was all over there. The Parisians were going to be there. They're going to sing, and it's these members and so on." So it was no way of getting out of it. Although we wanted to. So anyway, we get that night, I never forget it. We get in there and I'm walking out, and of course these are all our friends that a lot of them I knew.
Right.
Others I didn't know. And the whole school's there. Yeah, I mean they're a pretty big dance. So we get out there and we sang a cappella. We didn't sing with any music.
Cool.
Because we didn't have any.
No, yeah, I hear you. Did that for years.
Yeah. So, anyway, we get out there and we get on stage, and I remember my lips started quivering when I was, after one of our teachers announced us.
Right.
The lips started shaking.
And rightfully so.
And my knees started quivering.
I mean,
just moving, and I go, oh, my God. And we're looking at each other. We won't look at the audience.
Right.
We're just looking at each other, and we go into singing,
start
singing, and the place went nuts.
Cool.
We're hearing all our names being called and how good, and the applause, and boy, then we started kind of facing them.
And I'll bet the next tune was like much better, because that's what happens, man. You get encouragement from them, and wow.
So what happened was we started doing more and more dances, been asked to do more and more dances. Then, of course, the local radio stations here were real, they were really a good part of our career success, because we got to know quite a few. One was CKLW.
Right.
CKLW was a major Canadian station.
Right.
But it was, I believe then it was owned by an American, but it's now, I think, back in Canadian hands. But
right.
Anyway, that station used to get 27 states.
Wow.
So when you would be asked by them, they would talk about your group, and of course it was the Parisians back then, and they would talk about you, and we had the Parisians there last night, they did a fantastic, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Well, this guy, Dave Schaefer, that we were real close with, and Tom Shannon, and all these guys, Tom was originally from Buffalo, New York.
I know Tommy Shannon very well. His theme song was Wild Weekend.
Yeah, Tommy was one of our closest
WKBW.
Yeah, he was one of our closest friends.
I know, Tom.
And Joey Reynolds.
Yep.
Joey Reynolds was from out here. So anyway, we became a kind of a local radio station, kind of a positive thing for them. They would ask us to, almost all the stations here would ask us to come out and do an a cappella number or do a couple of a cappella numbers.
Yeah, now this was the Parisians, right?
Yes, the Parisians.
Okay.
Well, what had happened was, in '62, course, because of that, we were noticed by a couple of guys, Barry and Mark Stern, and they brought us to this Keiko Record Company.
Uh-huh, Keiko Records.
Right, Keiko Record Company. And what happened then, my mom, being that we came from New York, you know, the rooms in New York weren't very big, and we used to have a full wall mirror that was in there, a mirror that went from the floor to the ceiling.
Uh-huh.
And because of that, we used to stand in front of it in practice, and it was in our living room. And we had three lamps there, and we used to turn them up real, you know, to the they were like a three-way lamp, each
right.
one. And we'd turn them up real bright, and we'd stand in front of the mirror and, you know, kind of do little routines and sing and so on. And what was happening was we noticed the reflection on the floor was kind of really weird. It looked kind of mosaic-like.
Uh-huh.
With the three lamps. And we kept on seeing reflection.
Wow.
All night. Look at that reflection. Look at that. And, you know, we said, man, you know, that's a good name. That's a great name. So we started calling ourselves the Reflections. And,
wonderful.
From that point, like I said, we went to Keiko Record, and that was the first time we used Reflections with Keiko. Prior to that, we were Parisians.
Right.
And we recorded for them a thing called Helpless.
Right.
And You Said Goodbye. Now, Helpless was Phil Casterdale, our first tenor. He sang the lead on that. I don't have can't find a copy of that.
Hmm.
But the side that they played on the air was You Said Goodbye.
Gotcha.
Which I sang.
You said goodbye. You said goodbye. You made me cry. Please tell me why. Why did you break my heart in two and leave me all alone and blue? You play the game of love.
Well, I'll tell you what, maybe Mark Stern has a copy of that. Maybe
he does.
Maybe we'll try to find him. I wonder where he's hanging out. But, yeah, You Said Goodbye. That was one of the first ones that was played on the air.
Yep, that was the first Reflection song ever played on the air. And it did pretty well. I mean, people started noticing us. So we were doing record hops as Reflections. And, of course, that we pantomimed. That was the first time we didn't know how to pantomime, so we sang with it.
Now, what year was that? Do you remember?
62.
Now, where did the Laredos come in?
Well, the Laredos happened in 77. See, I've known the Laredos from 1956.
Okay, so let's put the Laredos on hold for a minute, and let's continue with the Reflections.
So anyway, we recorded for Keiko Records. We put the two records out,
right.
The one record out with the two songs on it.
Right.
And from that point on, we were apparently sold or bought by Golden World. Golden World came in, and they were looking for a group, and they were looking for a white group.
Gotcha.
And they were a black company.
Gotcha.
And a guy named Edwin Gayton and Joanne Bratton. Joanne Bratton was the wife of Johnny Bratton, the prize fighter.
Gotcha.
And so anyway, we got to Joanne's house. Very beautiful woman. Absolutely beautiful.
Uh-huh.
A Halle Berry, if you ever saw one.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she was just a knockout. And I loved her. I mean, she was just so,
so
nice.
So your knees were shaking and your lips quivering again.
When we got there, we said, boy, these are movie stars.
Right.
So anyway, and she had all these people around her, these musicians, and every one was a somebody. Every one of them played in, on Motown.
Wow.
These were all big-time people. So we get down in her basement, and we, of course, had to sing some stuff. So, of course, our harmonies were really tight.
Gotcha.
We were able to sing well. And Phil sang a lead, I sang a lead, and Phil and I were the only ones that would ever sing lead.
Who were the members of the Reflections at that
point? The original Reflections were, there was Ray Steinberg. Ray only stayed in the group a very, very short time.
Right.
There was Phil Castrodale, Dan Benny, John Dean, and myself.
Gotcha.
So when we were down there, and the type of music that we sang, and the type that we liked to sing was R&B. So we would sing a lot of the old classics, "Still of the Night," "One Summer Night," all the classics.
Probably Gloria.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Gloria.
Right.
Most of All.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd sing all these tunes, and in fact, I'm not sure if Harvey was there. I think Harvey was there. Harvey Fuqua.
Uh huh.
Yeah, because he was part, like I said, they were in the elite class. They had everybody that was anybody. And so we were down there, and of course they signed us. And then we worked with a guy named Freddie Gorman and Bob Hamilton.
Gotcha.
Freddie wrote Mr. Postman.
Gotcha.
And Bob Hamilton was mainly who we worked with more. There he was part of the production.
Gotcha.
But Bob Hamilton is who we worked more closely with, because he played the piano and sang. Well, of course, when we heard Romeo and Juliet, we started laughing. We didn't like the song.
Really?
Oh, yeah. We don't like it at all because, well, of course, he's singing it, and he's playing the piano. We don't hear what's in his head.
Okay.
As far as the production and as far as what it's going to sound like.
Uh-huh.
So we were kind of looking at each other going, this is going to be our first song from Golden World, this jelly bean thing. I couldn't stand it.
Right.
So we started trying to make it worse by putting stuff in it that we never did, like falsetto.
I hear you.
Yeah, we did that doot 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 doot.
Right.
Started putting that in there, and all of a sudden Bob says, "Oh, keep that. We love it." I'll go, "Oh no, no!" And we're going, "This is crazy. These people are nuts." So anyway, so we learned the song, okay, and the B side is called "Can't You Tell by the Look in My Eyes,"
right?
Which was written by Tony Clark and Popcorn Wiley, and that was a beautiful song.
You know I'm lonely, yes, I'm so lonely. You can tell by my look of despair. All of my life. I've been misunderstood. I need someone who means me good. You won't mistreat me. You won't defeat me. You'll never do me no wrong. 'Cause I know you're that one girl, that one in all this world. I can tell by look in your eyes, I can tell by look in your eyes, I can tell by look in your eyes.
Right.
That was the B-side to Romeo. And I tell you, it was a beautiful song.
And you liked that better.
I loved it.
Wow.
I loved it. Well, anyway, we're singing this stuff, and we get ready, and we're going to be recording. Now, our studio, Golden World, was being built at the time.
Wow.
It was on Linwood and Davison in Detroit. And it was being built, and it was going to be a one-of-a-kind studio because the board that they were using was, there was only four of them made. They were module boards, the first of its kind, where they'd have drawers that pull out if something went wrong. They'd pull the drawer out, put another drawer in.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's the way it was designed by this guy from Cleveland.
Right.
So anyway, the studio was under construction. So we never heard the band track being produced because the band track was produced at United Sound here in Detroit.
Okay.
So when we were done with our practicing, they said, okay, we're going to be going to Chicago to put the voices down at RCA Victor.
Right.
So the Ed Wingate says, okay, we're going to be leaving. I can't even remember what day it was, but it was during the week. And he said, we're going to take two cars, drive there, and we're going to put down the voices. Now, I have not heard Romeo. I have not heard anything.
Right.
Okay, no band tracks, no nothing.
Gotcha.
So we get out to RCA Victor and we walk in. Now, this is the first time I was in a studio that said, this is real big time.
Right.
This is a real big studio. I had Frank Sinatra on the walls, had all kinds of people on the walls there. And I'm walking down there and I'm going, oh my God, look at this. And we go into a studio that we had never been in before, and there's big time studio. And everything looked like what you'd see in the movies. You know, it was a studio we always dreamt that we would be in.
Right.
So we get in there, and of course, they're going to lay down the lead first. And this is what we did. We laid down the lead, and they had a background speaker there, but they wanted to go through the song.
Uh-huh.
So they asked me to come in, and they started the band track. And
right.
I didn't come in on time because I was so dumbfounded when I heard the sound.
Right.
That I couldn't believe.
Well, that's why they have something called take two.
Yes. I was so dumbfounded at hearing what I was hearing. The band track was so cool, I could not believe my ears.
Right.
Well, I only did it once. I only sang once.
Wow.
And it was done. Okay. Mm. And I go in, and I said, how was that? They said, we're going to keep it. I said, well, what about the group? He said, we're going to get them out there now.
So right, I hear you.
And they sing around the mic.
Right.
Now, I'm inside now listening to them.
Uh-huh.
Now I'm hearing the whole song. They're not.
Right.
But I am.
Right.
And I'm going, oh, my God, I couldn't even speak. I was almost crying inside.
I know that feeling.
Yeah, I had a lump in my throat. I couldn't speak. I just was listening to this and going, oh, my God, it's fantastic.
Right.
And, of course, we get done singing there, and we were asked to come back in and to put the hand claps in.
Gotcha.
Now, Bob, he was amazing. Because Bob used to say, listen, okay, this is the way I want you to do this. He says, I want two of you guys to clap on the beat.
Right.
Like,
right.
And he says, I want two of you guys to clap like this.
Oh.
So we're going, why, you know? So anyway, we get out there and we start doing that. So he laid the straight claps down first.
Right.
Then we went back and did the double clap.
Right.
And when we did, that was a little more difficult. You never realized how long a song is.
Oh, yeah.
When you're clapping for, you know, 3 minutes or so. Well, so anyway, we put the clap down, and then we go in and listen to it. And we just could not believe what we were hearing, how good it was.
Wow.
We knew that this record was going to make noise, but we had no idea it would make the noise it did.
Right.
You know, we had no idea that it was going to be as successful as it was.
Finding a job tomorrow morning. Got a little something I wanna do. Gonna buy something I could ride in. Take my girl, looking at the driving. All of gonna be written down in history. Just like Romeo and Juliet. I'm gonna buy her pretty presents, just like the ones in a catalog. I'm gonna show how much I love her. I let her know one way or the other. Our love's gonna be written down in history, just like Romeo and Juliet.
What were some of the songs that were on that album originally with Romeo?
Oh, there was, Broadway.
Right.
Turn the Place Out.
Right.
June Bride.
Soon she
Right.
Well, that's another thing I got to tell you about Uwe Now. Now, I didn't, someday I'll let you hear this, but
right.
This was, we were in the studio. You know how kids are.
Right.
Okay? We're in the studio, and the stuff that we're saying is not very clean.
Gotcha.
Okay? So this John's doing a bass. Boom, 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 boom. He's doing that, right? And we start putting in dirty words, okay, and funny things. Well, anyway, what happened was this song turned out that we had to learn it after it was recorded.
Uh-huh. I hear you.
From the record.
Because
we made it up while we were singing.
Uh-huh.
And it was called Uwe Now Now. I met her on a Monday, dated on a I met her on a Sunday, dated on a Monday. Uwe Now Now Now, Uwe Now Now.
Uh-huh.
But we went to a movie, a spooky, spooky movie, Uwe Now Now Now, so on. So
gotcha.
On. Anyway, it was hilarious. But we're going, they want us to sing this live. I don't know how it goes. We're all looking at each other. We got to learn this from stupid record. We don't even know what it is.
You know, I met her on a Sunday, I did it on a Monday. I took her to a movie, a spooky, spooky movie.
What about June Bride? Tell me about that tune.
Well, June Bride, my wife and I got married in 1964, and this song was kind of our wedding gift from Bob Hamilton.
Uh-huh.
They wrote this song for me, and so I sang it the night my wife Barb and myself were married at the reception. Now, she didn't know we were going to do this. And Bob had a great way with words. I used to, you know, anticipation. I mean, his words always were big words. I always laughed at that, of the words in that song, because when you listen to him, the emancipation, anticipation, all those kind of words were in there.
Gotcha.
Which were really funny. But I sang it to her the night that we had our wedding reception. And one of the DJs, my buddy, the DJ, and it was, I don't know if it was Tom Shannon, I think it was Tom Shannon that said it.
Uh-huh.
He announced that we're getting married, okay, on the air.
Wow.
We had all kinds of people at our reception that were bringing gifts that we didn't even know. Walking in the door saying, oh yeah, we have a gift for the bride and groom and so on and so forth.
Wow.
But, yeah, we had a ball, but that's where that song was written for us, and it was kind of a present.
Unbelievable. So, you know, Romeo comes out, and Romeo was your first big endeavor.
Yes, yes.
And here it goes, top 10.
Yeah, it went up to number six on the Billboard charts and on the R&B charts. Now, I never seen the R&B charts. They told me it went to 3.
Wow.
Some people told us it was number 1 in the R&B charts.
Works for me.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I didn't even know they had an R&B and Billboard chart. I always thought they were one and the same.
So you guys are teen idols and stars.
Yes.
With your first endeavor, which hardly ever happens. Remember when we talked about Mark Stern?
Yeah.
And Keiko Records? Well, I got a surprise for you, man. I have Mark Stern right in the studio. So, Tony McCalley, say hello to Mark Stern after all these years.
How are you? Man, I'll tell you, I haven't seen you or talked to you in 47 years?
Yeah, 47 years. Yeah.
I know. But, you know, I keep hearing about the reflections and everybody that knows my affiliation way back in 63, 64.
Right.
You know,
actually,
they keep telling me
that earlier
they
than
saw
that,
you, you know, and everybody says you guys are still great.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're having fun. You actually was around 63, wasn't
it? It was 63, actually.
63
I was still in high school. And I had a partner who,
Barry
Kay, right.
Yeah.
And, Barry Kay came from a family with a lot of money and, I had been in the record business with my brothers for Fortune Records back in 57, 58, 59. And Barry wanted to get into the business and, so he invested some money and we called the company Keiko.
Right.
K-A-Y-K-O. We put out a call for all the really good local talent to tell us about themselves and to make themselves known. And lo and behold, there was the reflections from McKenzie High School.
Well, actually, one of them was from McKenzie.
Oh, that's how I remembered it.
Yeah, I was from Thurston.
I was in Mumford.
Huh? And
I
you
was
were
going
from
to
Mumford?
Mumford during that time.
Yeah?
Mumford High School, yeah.
Still,
and we heard you guys and we flipped over you. We thought you were great. And we were putting together a bunch of, you know, local entertainers, including, I don't know if you remember any of these people, the Darlings.
Yeah, the Darlings.
Rick Martell.
Yeah, I remember it.
Whose real name was Ricky Drapkin. And you guys, and we took everybody.
And the Darlings.
Well, the Darlings, they kind of, they're spread out all over the country now, but I'm still in touch with them occasionally.
Yeah, well, what was their names? Now, was one Teresa?
No.
Judy
Cutler was the
Judy.
She was the lead singer.
Okay.
Marianne August.
Marianne
was one of the backup singers, and Donna King.
Donna
was the third one. Those were the Darlings, and they were. Judy was a real strong voice. She was.
Yeah, great. They had a very black sound.
Oh yeah, yeah.
They were fantastic.
You know, it's funny because I knew that I was going to be talking to you today, so I went into some of my collection of stuff and found the acetate, the demo record for You Said Goodbye.
Oh, my God.
And Helpless.
Yeah, Helpless and You Say Goodbye. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, and too bad there's no date on this thing, but it goes back to, and it's funny because I'm just looking at our publishing name back then was called Little Chance Publishing.
Well, you know, this is real good radio, you know, hooking you guys up because, as you say, you haven't spoken in years and years. And, you know, Mark, we have a great affiliation and we've sung together. And, you know, I will tell you, Tony, that Mark sings probably the best rendition of Romeo and Juliet in Southern Florida and is well respected for it.
That's great. That's great. Nothing wrong with that. Like I was telling Mike, ever since the PBS special, people realized we're still alive.
Yeah, I saw
of
that.
The Detroit area. Yeah.
I was greatly impressed. I really was.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody tells me that you guys really, really still have it together, which, you know, isn't very often that it happens after 48 years.
Yeah, well, you know, it's been fun for us because, well, the nice thing about our group now is we've got more than one lead singer. Because, you know, I can only listen to me so long before I get tired of me, too. So
right.
It's nice to have somebody able, some other guys in the group that can sing.
Right.
And sing well. We have a guy in the group that sings just like Jackie Wilson.
Oh, really? God, I remember back in those days, Jackie Wilson lived over on LaSalle Boulevard.
Yeah, we used to do record hops with him.
I used to go to his house all the time and listen to his mother sing better than he did. Yeah.
Well,
those were really the days. I mean,
didn't you have a brother? Didn't your brother work with you?
Yeah, well, we opened up another record company called Melody House.
And, what was your brother's name, Barry?
Gary was my partner.
Your partner. Okay, not Barry Kay.
Oh, no. My brother is Gary.
Okay, Barry, but it was Barry. Now, Barry used to wear, because we used to love when Barry would come in, he'd wear a camel coat with a fur collar. That's Barry, right?
That was his uniform.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, the guy, you know, I've been trying to find him for at least the last 25 years. And
it's not
Barry Kay. There's a Barry Kay down here who's very colorful, who's in the investment business, and he looks like him, but it's not him. And I would love to find Barry Kay today.
I haven't heard anything about him.
No, now, me either. Neither have I.
Isn't his father the one that created ethyl gasoline?
Yeah, his father developed ethyl gasoline and was, I think, the vice president of Marathon Oil.
Wow. That's amazing. You know, what I'd really like to do is to get down into the nitty-gritty of Romeo and Juliet and try to understand how the song really came about. Because when I search it on the net in a few places, it's very unsure as to what the derivation was of that tune.
Well, I'll tell you exactly how it went. There are some of my friends who were there at the time. I don't know if you remember, but Tony, back in 63, my father owned a drugstore on the corner of Livernois and Elmhurst in Detroit.
Yeah, I remember that.
And there was a studio apartment above his store that I rented.
Well, that's where we were rehearsed, isn't
it? Yeah, right. I rented that space above my father's store. And we would do all of our rehearsals in there.
Marty Coleman.
I'm sorry?
Barrett Strong. Marty Coleman and Barrett Strong were there.
Barrett Strong was there, Marty Coleman, and a guy by the name of Joel Rate. I don't know if you remember him.
No, I don't remember him.
But you know, everybody dropped in. It was like, it's kind of like a white Motown.
Yeah, right. It was.
You know, and,
Seminoles.
I put a piano up there, so that we could do rehearsals. And
right. You
guys were standing around the piano. When I played, I just played three chords, and just started singing a melody. And just like Romeo and Juliet was written in my office on that piano in about 10 minutes.
No kidding.
Yes. And what happened was, I wrote down the lyrics and I wrote the melody. And then when Barry Kay and I had a falling out, I decided I'm going to sell out of this and I'm going to go into Melody House with my brother. So I sold everything that I had to do with Keiko Records to Barry Kay, including Romeo, because it was a song that was meant for you guys. And from what I heard afterwards, and I want you to know how much I got for this song, you know, just like Romeo and Juliet, netted me $2,500 and for everything, including my equity in the company. $2,500 and a 62 Chevy convertible.
Yeah.
That's what I got in full payment of all of my efforts at Keiko Record Company, including the writing of Romeo and Juliet.
No kidding.
Let me tell you, I don't have to tell you about Barry Gordy or Mr. Wingate. Barry and I became friendly during the newspaper strike in Detroit. I was the guy that published the newspapers during the strike. It's called
the
Detroit Daily Press. I got friendly with Barry, and everything that Barry Kay had, from what I heard, he either lost it to him in a card game or in a Scrabble game or something. And all of the holdings of Keiko Records wound up going to Barry Gordy. Well, Barry Gordy had a couple of friends from the post office because, you know, Barry Gordy was a postman.
Yeah.
And he had two friends, Hamilton and Gorman.
Right, right.
And anything that he purchased, because he had so many songs in his name already from other acquisitions that he made, he put these songs all in the name of Hamilton and Gordon, whether they wrote it or not. So when he inherited, just like Romeo and Juliet from Keiko Records, who inherited it from me when I sold my interest, He wound up putting their name on it, and that's how, to this day, they are given credit for that record. But
I had no idea because, of course, you know, we were there when Bob Hamilton played it for us, and we were listening to it, and I was telling Mike, I said, when of course you hear it from a writer standpoint, a guy playing the piano, and he's singing it to us, I'm going, this song stinks. We don't want to do this. So we started putting in all that stuff, that falsetto stuff.
Yeah.
We threw that in there as a joke, and then
that
he turned around
in
and
it.
Said,
when
yeah,
I wrote
keep
it,
that
the guy said, yeah, you rearranged it. But the original song, the melody and the lyric, was mine, but you changed a lot of it by putting the falsetto in it.
And that's amazing to me because, you know, Mark, as we both know, you know, the people that love you and know you in Southern Florida all know when they hear you sing it with that kind of feeling that you sing it with, that in your heart it belongs to you. And, you know, it's just amazing. Here's a tune that became such a giant hit for the Reflections. And it happens in the music business quite often that, you know, nobody really knows what gets the entire picture. You just know what your involvement is in it.
Right. That's
well,
right.
But now I'm enlightened by that because I had no idea. Yeah,
well,
because,
listen, he did
of course,
the same
back
thing.
Then,
if you recall, Berry Gordy also purchased Rin Tin Records. And I'm just looking this up on the web.
Rick Tick.
And at the time, Hamilton or Gordon, I'm not sure which one, they were with Rin Tin.
Rick Tick.
Rick Tick, sorry.
Yeah, Rick Tick. Golden World. You know, and Golden World was the record company we were with, not Motown.
I know.
And
Ed Wingate
and Joanne Bratton were the ones that owned that. But they were in cahoots with Berry Gordy.
I know.
You know, so that's...
Listen, I remember those days. I remember sitting around the studio, and Tony, I don't think you were around yet at that time, but I remember sitting around the studio with little 8-year-old Stevie Wonder, and Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell and the Marvelettes and Smokey was around because he was there from the beginning. I mean, these people, nobody even knew their name back in those days.
And they
went from that to becoming famous.
Yeah,
unfortunately, yeah. I really believe, and I don't want to get sued for this, but I really believe that the only one who really made any real money out of it was Berry Gordy.
Oh, no question.
Because I think Berry had Stevie Wonder's mother on a salary rather than on a per-record basis.
Well, Mark, I know that by talking to the Vells, you know, the girls from the Marvelettes and all, a lot of the interviews that I've done, speaking to Mary Wilson, that Berry ruled with an iron hand. Everybody respected him and called him, you know, Mister, but when he was done with you, he was done with you, and he would show you, you know, because they were young kids when they signed, and then years later he would show them, you see this little clause that nobody ever read?
Right.
You know, I disappear you now. And that was the end of
Correct.
It.
That's absolutely
that's how
right.
it was.
And it's not any different for writers. You know, once he puts it on Jobette Publishing and, you know, takes it out of whatever it was originally, it's his. And he ruled that too. So, he was a brilliant guy. And I remember I used to sit in his office and listen to all the groups that were auditioning for him. And he'd look across the desk from me and say, "What do you think?" And I'd shake my head, yes or no. I brought a girl into him also by the name of Connie Van Dyke. Do you remember her?
Yes, I remember Connie Van Dyke.
Yeah, she was really good, and she had a song called Freddie.
I remember that.
And I mean, everybody, we were all kids. We were just kids.
Oh, yeah.
Who ever thought that you and I would be talking on the phone almost 15 years
amazing?
Later talking about...
Well, of course, we're down in Florida. Definitely, you got to come out see the group.
Well, you know, Mark, what's going to happen is that whenever the Reflections are there, you and I will get together and we'll go together and make sure that we go and kiss and hug and partake of it. Because,
I would love that.
You know,
I have to tell you, Tony, it's been very frustrating over the years. Because when your name is taken off a song when you sell it, and everybody says, I don't believe you. I don't believe you wrote it.
Sure.
And then I run into a guy who I think you'll remember by the name of Al Abrams.
Yeah, I know Al.
Okay,
yeah.
Al called me during, I was publishing a newspaper in Detroit a couple years ago, and he called me up and he said, and I told him what was happening. He said, I was there when you wrote the song. How can people say it wasn't you? It was you.
Isn't that amazing?
So,
well, we were fed a line too, because when Bob Hamilton and Freddie Gorman were around us teaching us this, we assumed that they were the writers.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because they were, that's who we learned from.
They were given the song.
And
I have to tell you, you have a new album that was on Amazon that I bought.
No kidding.
On the back of it, I actually did get some credits as the producer for Keiko on a couple of your songs. But it really hurts when I look at this thing and it's like Romeo and Juliet says Hamilton and Gorman on it.
Isn't that, well, see, that's something I had no idea.
Yeah.
I knew no, well, that's the other part of the story that I,
talent has always kept in the dark on that. Tony, I can't tell you, you know, I've thought about being able to talk to you again and just never really had the opportunity, and I want to thank Mike Miller for putting us back together again after all these years. It's wonderful to talk to you and hear your voice.
Oh yeah, it's great to talk to you. I mean, you know, like I said, this is deja vu for me. I love it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, well, you know, you guys are both my friends, and of course, Mark, you know how deep our friendship goes, and you know, it's Mark Stern from Southern Florida, also known as Mark Allen on stage, and you know, it's all good. It's all good. It's all about creativity, and it's all about the music business, and I love it.
Send my love to the rest of the guys. Will you play?
Yeah, I will. I will.
Soon.
All right, you take care.
Wow, that was fabulous. Mark Stern. So tell me, Tony, what came next for you guys?
We had some great material, great songs written for us. We had a song called Coming At You.
As soon as I can get my whole self together,
hear you. Well, you know, tell me about Columbus.
Yeah, well, Columbus was a cute song, and it was too much like Romeo.
And as I remember, it was pretty much the same hook, and the record companies do that a lot. They figure if they have you with this sound, we're going to stay in that mode, you know.
Gonna take a little expedition, going out for a long way to discover the kind of girl I want for a lover. Gonna find
I know the song well.
Yeah, that song was very much English sounding.
Right.
It were very Beatle-like.
Gotcha.
We wanted that one out. And then later, we wanted Columbus to be put out like 2 or 3 years later.
I hear you.
But the company does what the company does.
You
they
bet.
Didn't listen to us. They didn't care about what we said. And it was just, you know. And we know that that was a good portion of the fact that we lost the popularity then, because you go out as, oh, that's the group that does that kind of music. You know?
I hear you. You get a certain
yeah.
stigma gets attached to you. That's what they do.
Exactly. Just like like they do with entertainers.
Right, I mean, and you guys and you guys wanted that you guys wanted that ballad badly, right?
Yes, we wanted the ballad. You're My Baby and Don't You Forget It would have been a great song. We had Coming at You. We had Poor Man's Son.
Each day with the rising sun, I got a job and it must be done. I leave for work feeling good, 'cause you're on my mind. Starts of you help me pass the time. I'm a poor man's son. Push and go, working with a smile. Just loving you makes it all worthwhile.
I'll get my pay like the rest when the week is through. Gonna buy you something that pleases you.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah. But in 65, when Poor Man's Son was released, we were on a Dick Clark tour at the time.
Gotcha.
And I never forget this, because we couldn't wait for this record to be released, and it was picked. In fact, I had the cover of Record World, where the cover states that Poor Man's Son and the Supremes, the Supremes were the pick hit of the week, and right, the sleeper of the week was us with Poor Man's Son.
Gotcha.
All disc jockeys all across the United States. That's the reason it got on the cover.
Uh-huh.
Well, it would have been great if you could find one in the store.
Yeah.
We would Phil and I would, you know, while we're on this tour, you know, we're in a different state every night, just about.
Wow.
Doing the one-nighters, you know. We'd stop in a record store. They didn't know who we were, and we didn't tell them who we were. But we came in there and said, "Hey, you got that Poor Man's Son by the Reflections?" Mm-hmm. "Yeah, I wish I did."
Wow.
Said, so, you know, we had a lot of people come in and ask for it, but we can't get it.
So they didn't distribute it, right?
No, no. I mean, it was nowhere. It was no. You couldn't buy it anywhere.
Wow.
Hardly any place you could find that record. And it was so disappointing to us, because we knew. Even Dick Clark told us the same thing. He just thought Poor Man's Son was so different, so new. And he said, that's going to be a great record for you. And we did American Bandstand when we did it on there. We did Shindig, Chivalry, Shaboom, Lloyd Thaxton. We did them all.
Oh, I remember Lloyd Thaxton. How about Clay Cole?
No, Clay Cole. I don't think we did Clay Cole, but we did in New York. We did. What's his name?
Murray.
Murray. Yeah, we did Murray.
Murray. Yeah, you guys were at the Brooklyn Fox.
Yep, we did Murray's show.
Yep.
And like I said, we had the sad part about that is we kind of knew something was going on, but we didn't know what, you know. And it was just a strange thing. The company was just not promoting us the right way.
Wow.
And I, you know, in 65, 66, I'm going to say around 67, I just said, you know, that's enough.
You know what's funny, though, too, I remember Lloyd Faxon. He was on Channel 13 in New York, and he was, you know, you had a lot of choices at that time. What about Shabby Little Hut?
Shabby Little Hut, yeah. Written by Van McCoy.
Ah, I didn't know that.
Your folks say they don't want me hanging round, 'cause I come from the wrong part of town. So I meet you in a secret place after dark when the sun goes down. In a shabby little hut by the dock, down by the sea.
I remember Bell. Great studio.
Yeah, very good studio. In fact, Teacho Wilshire, Teacho was producing it.
Oh.
So this is the first time I ever heard violins. I always wanted to sing with real violins.
Right. We want to be like the Skyliners. Can you do it for us?
and this was the first time that we had ever performed or sang with everybody.
Wow.
I mean, everybody was in the studio with us performing at the same time.
You mean full tilt? Yeah, I've done some of those sessions.
And that
was
the first time we ever done that. But while we were there, well, how Shabby came about was Shabby was written for the Drifters. And when we heard that, we said, man, the Drifters. Anything the Drifters gets a hit, right?
Right.
So we said, boy, is it a good song? And, you know, Van McCoy was the writer, and they said, well, you know, I think you could do it.
Right.
So we got it, and we started rehearsing it, and we went and recorded it, and it turned out very well for us. And we started singing that. See, a lot of our records were number one in a lot of states, but I didn't know that.
Wow.
Because, you know, it's not like the internet. Today, the internet could tell you a lot about how you're doing nationally.
Yeah, whole different ballgame.
Yeah. Where back in the old days, you were lucky to find out how you were doing in the next county.
Right.
You had no idea. So you only went by the word of the company. Hey, how many records are we selling? We doing okay?
You know, that's interesting with drifters because you might know this. Only in America it was written for the drifters. And after they recorded it, they actually were told, you know, it's going to be pretty tough to have a black group getting out there and saying, only in America could you grow up to be president and have a black group do it. And so they actually took it away and they gave it to Jay and the Americans. And the Drifters put that out on an album. But they actually didn't want to lead with the Drifters because they thought it was something that people wouldn't accept.
Isn't that amazing?
And that was not that long ago.
Yeah, you know, and it's really sad. I mean, I just love the guys I work with now, the black groups that I work with,
oh,
the old timers, because they're so true to themselves.
You bet, man. And we could run down the list. Oh. Of all of them, I mean, you and I have a long list of guys that we've worked with stage that, you know, I mean.
Well, they thought we were black.
You know, Speedo being one of them. I mean, you know.
We're black. In fact, you know, many of the places that we performed at.
You got to work at the Apollo.
Yeah.
And what a thrill that must have been.
Yeah, 1964, we were asked to sing at the Apollo. Now, this is the funny part about that is when we went to New York, we stayed at my grandmother's house. In the
uh-huh.
You know, I lived on Edison Avenue then. And so my grandmother had a brownstone house. Well, you know, it was two-story.
Right.
A basement. She rented out. Well, when we got there, all the guys would stay at her house. So we're telling her, where are you going to go sing? Because my family didn't know I even sang. So what do you mean sing? What are you going to sing? And this is my grandma's broken English, so it was even funnier.
Yeah, what's the matter you? You're not going to sing.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the first time we went to New York, which was like the first time we went to New York was we sang at Freedom Land.
Oh, knew it well.
Yes.
That's where Co-op City is now.
And we were the stars of the show.
And Scott Muni used to record live from there. Remember him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we were the stars of the show because our record was number one there.
Wow.
So that's the only reason we were a star. But here we're working with guys that had 10 hits.
Wow, unbelievable.
And we're going, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? We're the main act?
Freedom Land was a great venue.
Wasn't it? Yeah. So when I went to New York and when we first got there, I'm going to just tell you a little bit about that story. When I got there, when we sang at Freedom Land, we get down there. I never forget. I come in and I tell my grandmother, hey, Grandma, can you put up four guys? Four guys for what? Well, what's going on? I said, well, we're coming in to sing. You sing? Then you start singing.
You should have just told her, listen, make some pasta.
Oh, my God, it was
go hilarious. Boil some water.
Honest to God. So we get in there, and she says, what do you mean you sing? Yeah, we got a hit record. What's a hit record? You know, and on and on.
Right, I hear you.
So, of course, my cousins find out we're in. So one of my cousins lived down the street, so he comes over. And the funny part about it, well, you know, he speaks good English.
Right.
So he's explaining to her what happened, and he's dumbfounded because uh-huh. He says, that's you.
Wow.
So anyway, needless to say, we had 300 of my relatives at that show.
What could be better?
Oh, my God, it was funny. And so after we did that show, the following the show, they wanted to meet everybody. Leslie Gore was on the show.
Right.
I remember. And King Curtis was our band.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So... And back then, he had a big orchestra.
Right.
And he was playing Romeo with an enormous orchestra compared to what we, you know, all we had was sound on sound.
Unreal.
So it was fantastic. Well, anyway, the following time we come in, we're at the Apollo. Now, with
we come in, the same thing. Now, my grandmother knows we sing now, but what was funny was they said, where are you going to go? I said, well, we're singing in Harlem. What, are you nuts?
Yeah, right.
So what do you mean? That's where we're singing.
125th Street.
Yeah. He said, where are you singing in Harlem? I said, 125th. What are you crazy? Get killed. That first thing they said, I said, Grandma, we sing for our black audiences all the time.
Right, we're the stars.
Our best audience.
Right.
Well, they don't understand. And we never had that kind of seeing that kind of...
Right, that mindset. I understand.
Yeah, that mindset.
Yeah.
So anyway, we did the Apollo Theater, and we get to the Apollo, and we knock on the back door, and the guy comes out, little old guy comes out, and he says, yeah, can I help you? See, Reflections? He says, the Romeo and Juliet? I said, yeah. Ooh. He goes like, ooh. He goes like that, and he goes back. I go, what the hell was that about?
Right.
So we're still waiting outside. So he goes out, comes back, and he says, yeah, come on in. Now, we had done work with the Coasters. Now, this is Speedo, when Speedo was singing with them.
Oh, you mean when Speedo was singing with the Coasters, right?
Yeah, with the Coasters.
Yes, he was with them a long time.
The headliners.
Right.
Of the show.
Right.
Tommy Hunt.
Right.
In fact, while we were there, Mary Wells came to visit us.
Gotcha.
She was in town. And we did tons of record hops with her. So she came in to meet us, and she brought with her Dionne Warwick's sister.
Dee Dee Warwick?
Dee Dee Warwick. They brought them there. And so, I mean, we got accepted. So the night of the show, you know, of course, they mentioned, just like Romeo and Juliet, the audience is going crazy, and we go out to the place, you're going to hear a pin drop.
Right.
So we're going, oh, it's time to die. You know? But we started singing, and they were fantastic to us.
Wow.
And Speedo was I loved Speedo.
I love him too, man.
We had more fun with him because you know what he used to do? He used to try and make me laugh all the time. Now, Speedo used to do the Jerry Colonna eyes.
Right. Oh, yeah, he does the big eyes thing.
When
you know.
He used to do, and then they found, you know, when they do Charlie Brown and all these things, tied her up on a railroad track, and then he'd roll his eyes.
Right.
Well, I'd laugh every time he did that. Pretty soon he was popping up in the audience while I'm singing.
Wow.
I'm up there singing, and all of a sudden there comes Speedo's little head sticks up, and he's doing his eyes. And, you know, of course, they start laughing.
Yeah.
But anyway, we had a ball. We were there 10 days.
I love him. Every time I call him, he goes, how you doing, Brother Mike?
Hi. This is Earl Speedo Carroll of the Cadillacs, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Yeah, he was a big guy. Just loved them guys. And Carl Gardner, then that was Carl was with him. He used to sing. What was it? Satin Lace.
Right. Well, you know, I did Carl's last interview, believe it or not, and I went to his funeral, and his funeral is like a who's who, you know, because he was a great one.
Hello, this is Carl Gardner from the Coasters. We're listening to the Harmony Street Show with Mike Miller.
Fantastic group. That group was, I had more fun. Well, we broke his Billy's finger.
Huh?
Pinky finger. Because we were playing handball on the back.
Oh, no.
Yeah, outside, you know, across the street.
Right.
From the Apollo in the back.
Uh-huh.
Apollo. There was a yard there. So we were playing handball, and we broke his little finger.
Oh,
so
no.
That's how he remembered us years later.
Wow.
It was funny. Do you remember Billy's finger broken? Yeah. So we did it.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, so we had a lot of fun.
Well, you know, be glad it wasn't Curly the guitar player.
Yeah, right.
Do you remember Curly?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. He's still around.
You know, we, who did we see there? I'm trying to think. I think Gladys Knight and the Pips were there.
Wow.
And Gladys was a friend of ours because she, in Detroit, Johnny Dean's father-in-law owned the skating rink on 8 Mile. And they used to take their kids there. So Johnny knew them real well. Johnny knew her real well.
Wow.
So when we were on, did some shows with her,
she was always close with us, you know, so I hadn't seen her in years since, but the Pips were nice kids. I mean, you could tell the class that they grew up with. They were just so nice to everybody.
Well,
and they weren't the big stars that you can't talk to me.
And so many people came out of Detroit. I mean, and, you know, everybody I've spoken to, you know, Mary Wilson and the girls, you know, from the Vels, you know, with Motown and you know, the list goes on and on. Just marvels at the amount of talent that came out of Detroit.
Hi, this is Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and you're listening to my friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show, and we just have so much fun. My baby love, me and Mike Miller. Woo!
Oh, yeah. Mary Wilson was an exception. She was my pal. She was dating Levi at the time. When we were on the tour with her, and
right.
with Supremes, in fact.
But she still tells me the story about how, you know, they were on the bus on the tour with Dick Clark, and they would stop at a diner, whatever, and they had to still wait on the bus. And one time they were on the bus, and Len Barry decides that he's going to go into the deli and he's going to bring back sandwiches for everybody. So Diana says, "I've had it. I'm going into this place and I'm just going to order some food and whatever." And she wound up getting thrown out and couldn't believe that somebody would throw out of a deli in the South Diana Ross, who had three or four number one records at that time, and it still happened.
It was pretty sad. It was
yep.
sad back then. See, I had never seen Prejudice
right.
like I did when I was on tour.
Oh, yeah.
I had never known it existed to that point, because growing up in New York, I had a lot of black friends in New York.
Oh, yeah, of course. So, you know, we sang on the corners with, you know, just about anybody. Anybody who's
exactly.
anybody who could hit the note was in the group, man. I don't care what he looked like.
And when we were on tour, never forget this, we were singing in Savannah, Georgia. And it was going to be an outside venue. And we get to this ballpark. It was a ballpark. It was part of the Dick Clark tour. We get to this ballpark, and then we look in there, and it says white, you know, on the bathrooms.
Right.
Women, white, men, other. And I goes, "What the hell's that?"
Wow.
And they said, "What do you mean, what's that?" I said, "What's other?"
Uh-huh.
And he says, "We're other."
Oh, man.
I said, "Come on." He says, "No, they don't play around down here."
Unbelievable.
I said, "Are you kidding me?" And then they had the drinking fountains the same way. And what was so sad was here, the biggest audience for the blacks were whites.
Yeah.
That's who bought their records.
Oh, sure.
Yet, that's who had nothing to do with them.
Listen, when I was a
dean. In the same room with them.
When I was a dean in the Bronx, I'm sure you remember Jimmy Keys and the Chords.
Yeah, sure.
And Jimmy wrote Shaboom, and I would invite him to, I had his sons, Paul and Jimmy Jr., and they weren't great kids. They used to say, "My father's burned out," you know, what I said, "Your father's a legend." And he would come to career day and talk to the people in the auditorium, and he would tell them how tough it was, how the black groups died on the R&B charts, and the white groups would cover their material.
Oh, like what's his name?
The Crew Cuts, you know, covered Shaboom and had a hit, you know.
One singer, I'm sorry to say, and I hate if this is going on the air, that I have no respect for.
Go ahead.
White Bucks.
Uh-huh. I hear you.
I could not stand the fact that he would come out and sing Little Richard stuff.
Right.
And became the hit.
And did it in a white bread way and took all that soul, put all the soul in his back pocket, and did it for the white audiences. There were quite a few groups that did that.
Oh, yes, and I couldn't stand it. I wouldn't even listen to it. Because, like I said, Eddie had, my buddy Eddie that I grew up with,
right.
had all his records. And I thought he was fantastic.
Right. You know, well, you know, let's put it this way. Even the Diamonds, when they cut Little Darlin', That tune, that, you know, they covered that tune.
Maurice Williams wrote that, mm-hmm. Yeah. I know, I mean, but there's guys you have respect for and there's guys you don't. I never had respect for Mr. Whitebucks himself.
Yeah, but you know what?
I just didn't like the fact.
Here's the deal. It's America.
Yeah.
It's a question of, you know, fulfilling a need and supply and demand, and he just went for it in his own way, and, you know, that's what he did. Musically and creatively, I understand that because I feel the same way that you do. You can't take something that's already perfect and make it imperfect.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of it had to do – well, that's the way I feel today with even – fans come up and talk to us and stuff. I mean, we owe every single thing that we do to every fan that comes up and talks to us.
I hear you.
You know, and I've seen guys that have gotten so big that the last thing they want to talk to is a fan.
No, I know, and they refuse autographs and they stick their nose up, and I've seen it.
I hate the fact that you wouldn't be standing here if it wasn't for the people that have come to see you and supported you.
I agree, and that's
right. Treat them that way.
And that's a very pure thought, Tony. You know, let's talk more about your music. Who's Tony Michaels?
Tony Michaels is. This is another funny thing. Back when I signed up with Golden World,
right?
I didn't know there was a clause in my contract because I was too dumb to really look at the clauses in the contract. All I cared about was being signed. And it stated that if I ever left the group, that I would, and wanted to remain in the business, that I would have to sing as a solo.
Uh-huh.
And I never wanted to sing as a solo. I was used to growing up with harmony and a group.
Right.
And I didn't like being out in front. And this is something that I didn't realize I signed.
Right.
So when I quit our group, and that was around 66, somewhere around there,
uh-huh.
I came home, and Golden World, of course, was telling me that that I'd have to perform, or I have to record a solo.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to do that. Said, well, we'll get you the girls singing your background and all so on and so forth. Well, I didn't want to do that, but I said, you know, can I write, if I write a song, can I record it? And they said, sure. So I wrote a song called Picture Me and You.
Uh-huh.
And which would have been the first song that I had written and been able to sing, because that's where the money was, you know.
Oh, yeah, and the publishing and the writing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I did that.
On a cozy night, ended with a candlelight. Use it playing soft and low, brightening the candle glow. And then, picture me and you. Oh, what a perfect rendezvous. Don't leave, my angel baby. In a meadow far away, at a robin's melody, think how lovely that would be. And then, picture me and you. Oh, what a perfect rendezvous. Thank you.
way when we're in our warm embrace. It takes us to each lovely place.
So then, picture me and you wearing a perfect rendezvous. Oh, what a perfect rendezvous. So then, picture me and you wearing.
And the B side of the record was I Love the Life I Live and Live the Life I Love. Now on the...
Say that 10 times fast.
Yeah, I know. So anyway, when we get into the studio and I sing my song, they wanted me to sing kind of Smokey-like, Smokey Robinson-like.
Right.
And I said, that'll kill me.
Right.
I mean, I was young then. Of course, I was only 24, 25 then.
You wanted to belt it out.
Yeah, and it's not only belting it, you're using a false voice up on top.
I hear you.
In some of your notes, and, you know, I strained with that because that wasn't what I did. I had to sing loud.
Okay.
You know? I wasn't a soft singer. So anyway, I wasn't comfortable singing like that. So I Picture Me and You was a little better for me than I Love the Life I Live and Live the Life I Love.
Gotcha.
Well, I get into the studio and we record this, and I had, you know him as Dawn.
Right.
Thelma Hopkins. And they were only 16 years old.
Wow.
These kids. And they were great. Thelma was as funny then as she is now. I always loved her.
Wow.
Because she was just the cutest little thing, and she always had the greatest sense of humor wherever we would perform together. They were called the Debonairs.
Uh-huh.
So they were part of Golden World. Well, anyway, we get to the studio, and the band track was pretty hot. I liked the band track of the song, so I'm singing it, but it's really killing me to sing that way. And so we record it, finish it, you know, and the record, waiting for the record to be put out. Well, Len Barry had 1, 2, 3.
Which was written by my good friend John Madara, by the way.
Okay, well, 1, 2, 3 comes out, I think, a week or two before mine. Now, if you listen to both of them.
Wow.
You got to listen to both of them.
Uh-huh.
And you'll, the same feel on the one I wrote.
Unbelievable.
And it was, I never heard 1, 2, 3 until it was out.
Uh-huh.
I knew it was a strong song.
Right.
The minute I heard it, I says, I'm dead. did a couple of TV shows singing Picture Me and You and right. I Love the Life I Live, local and one regional. And anyway, I knew the writing's on the wall on both of them because 1, 2, 3 was the better song and sung well. So I knew that that was going to fall. And I didn't care because I didn't want to sing alone.
I hear you.
You know, I didn't care if it worked. It worked. So I just quit. I said, you know, I've had it. I don't want to deal with this company anymore. I don't want to deal with what's going on in the business. I mean, it's one letdown after the other. We're not making any money. I mean, I don't think the group grossed 11 grand to split five ways. Yeah. I mean, it was ridiculous. Yeah. And I knew the money we were making for the corporation. So, I always look back at that and I'd say, boy, did you know, when you're young, you don't realize how manipulative older people were.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, all of the Motown people told me, you know, how Berry was, you know, that when he was done with you, he was done. I mean, he would just say, okay, you're done.
Oh, yeah.
Goodbye.
Yeah, and it's sad. It's really sad because the talent was there. I mean, we could still sing. We still had the ability to make hit records, and we still had a whole bunch of records in a can that nobody ever heard.
Well, you know, what
labels.
What happened at this point in
your career? I left the group in, like I said, 65. I quit.
Right.
Because I don't know if I told you the story about, we had a shot in 65 on the Dick Clark tour.
Right.
We had done a movie for Columbia Pictures called Winter A-Go-Go. And Winter A-Go-Go was... it was a fun movie, but you know we were going to have.
It was like a beach blanket movie, but during
and
the winter.
It was supposed to have the theme to the movie, sing the theme to
right.
the movie, as well as being in the movie. Now we had talking parts in there, but
right.
they ended up on the editing floor.
I hear you.
Well, anyway, when we did that movie, it was fun, and the guy that produced the movie and directed it was Richard Benedict, the actor,
right.
and writer and performer. And Richard always used to come up to me, and it was funny because he would tell me to do things when I'm singing. And of course, I can't see myself. It's not TV.
Right.
And you can't look at the camera.
Right.
And I kept looking at me. After I saw the movie, I wanted to choke him.
Right.
Because I looked like just terrible. I hated looking
so
at
So he was choreographing you.
Oh, my God, it was weird the way I sang, moving my jaw a certain way. Oh, it was stupid. Well, anyway, but I did enjoy doing the movie. It was kind of fun. A lot of waiting around and doing that kind of stuff.
Right.
But we had done the movie for Columbia Pictures, and he kept on telling me, he says, you're great for the movies. You're great for the movies. You know, your group is great for the movie. The guys really look good. On and on and on. Okay, well, anyway, what happened on that tour was in 65, Dick Clark came up to us and said, listen, we've got a meeting with some people. So he says, okay. Well, the meeting was with some of the Columbia people, but we didn't know who they were.
Right.
So we got there and we're sitting around a table there, and I'm sitting furthest away from them. I'm on the other end of the table, and one of the background singers, Dan Benny, he was singing close to them, or sitting close to
right.
them. And what had happened was they had turned around and asked us, well, what do we think about being in 7 beach party movies?
Wow.
And Danny said, well, I don't know, we'll have to think about it.
Oh, my God.
Now, you don't do that. You know, if I was on that side, I'd be kissing the guy.
Right.
Are you kidding? We'll be there tomorrow, you know? But because of what was said that day, they knew we would be a problem.
Oh, man.
That's exactly how it went down. They didn't talk to us after that, didn't deal with us after that, and we lost. That was our career. We knew it. It would have been over by then. So I left. And at the time, we
what did Dick have to say about that? Because I know you were very close to Dick Clark.
Yeah, yeah. And I told him, I says, you know, this is it. I'm done. Group's over. I'm leaving. So I quit the group, but on that tour with us was a guy named Darren Deanna. Darren was a nice kid, good singer, easily, I always looked at him, easily a better singer than I was. But he's a very, very good singer, and I says, you know what, why don't you, you know, you can be their lead. I don't want to be it. So I left, went home, and literally looked for a job, and I ended up at Chrysler. Building engines at Chrysler Corp.
Unbelievable. You were a Mopar guy.
Yep. There was a major layoff there, around 78.
Right.
I didn't go back when they called me back. Uh-huh. I didn't want, I said, you know, I had it.
I will tell you that I've been listening to Be Loved. It's just like so over the top good. And
that's Joey.
Yeah.
That's Joey in our group. Yeah, that's Joey. That's Joey Fanazzo's. Back in 1962, he was with a group called the Seminoles.
Wow.
And Joey sang like Jackie even then.
Wow.
The way he sings.
Fantastic version.
Oh, he's fantastic. He's now, got a beautiful voice. And he's in his mid-70s.
Wow. To Be Loved.
Someone to care, someone to share lonely hours and moments of despair. To be loved, to be loved. What a feeling to be loved. Someone. Someone to miss when you're away, to hear from each day. To be loved, to be loved. What a feeling to be loved. Some wish to be a king or a queen. Some wish for fortune and fame. But to be truly, truly, truly loved is more.
Some of your favorite Reflections tunes?
Well, my favorite was Poor Man's Son.
Uh-huh.
I like Can't You Tell.
Right.
I loved You're My Baby and Don't You Forget It, only because, now, you got to put that in the era that it was created.
Right.
You know, this is the one that's kind of Beatle-like.
Right.
And then a record that I always had fun singing was Don't Do That to Me.
Uh-huh.
That was a fun record to sing.
Right.
Because it had... It was fun to sing the lead in that because it had a lot of syncopated, to the beat, singing. You know, when you sang to the beat, you're singing on the beat. It's really cool.
I hear you.
Love that song. But, I was always a ballad singer when I was.
Yeah, no, I understand, which I, you know, I like to do too. What about Missing the 50s again?
Well, I wrote that. Missing the 50s, I wrote. And
I wrote it. It was funny. I wrote it when I was with the Laredos, Reflections. See, Laredos, the only reason, I'll explain that to you so you understand this.
Right.
In 1977, I was asked to take the place of their lead singer, a guy named Ronnie Morris.
Mm-hmm.
And Ronnie was a great singer, R&B singer. Ronnie left the group, and I was really not singing then. I wasn't doing anything.
Gotcha.
I was working at Chrysler. So what had happened was I got a call to basically take his place. So they wanted me to come down for an audition, and I really didn't want to because I kind of had a bad taste in my mouth with the industry and what it had done to me before.
Right.
But I... But then, on the other hand, I love doing it, you know. So I went down there with these guys and met them and just had a ball that night. I really enjoyed myself. Those are the two two things that we did was Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow and You Didn't Care.
Gotcha.
Now, that the reason I never use Reflections then was because I didn't want to be the big shot coming into their group when they were around in 56 when we were.
Right.
Okay, they just didn't happen to get a hit. I didn't want to be the big shot come in and say, okay, well, you're going to have to change your name and you're going to have to use Reflections. You know, I just didn't want to do that. So I came in and I was singing the lead for them and we were doing mostly a cappella shows. And we do 3 hours a cappella. But I noticed with a cappella, the problem with a cappella is it's very good for a while.
And then people kind of turn off to it because there's no the dynamics are missing.
Yes. And they start talking over it.
I know. I've been there.
They'll love you. They'll love you. They say you're great and all that, but they, you know, it has that tendency.
Right.
We started getting a band. Now, Tommy and the group back then, the original five guys in Laredo's were Gary Banovitz. There was Bernie Turnbull, Tommy Hust, myself, and John Dean. So when we joined them, well, I brought John in later. We had another bass, Rick Banco, but he had left. He had a heart condition.
Right.
So I brought in John. So there was two Reflections and three Laredos in the group. So when we go out and perform, we always did Romeo and Juliet.
Right.
So the promoters were saying, listen, I can't book you on the Laredos.
Right.
I can book you on the Reflections. So we said, okay, let's do this.
And also because you're the original lead singer and it works nicely for me.
Right. So what happened was did this. We said anything that we do in Michigan in the local area, we are Laredos. Outside the local area, Bay City, anything up north, we're Reflections. Because Reflections had national exposure and they were everywhere.
Okay? Absolutely.
Where Laredos weren't, okay? Yet, in Pittsburgh, the Laredos had a big smash hit. Freaks me out. I mean, of course, Romeo was a hit there, too, but they had a thing called Now the Parting Begins, where Ronnie Morris sang, and he's a good singer. And that was a big hit for the people in Pittsburgh. When we got to Pittsburgh, we had to learn that.
Gotcha.
So, anyway, and Joey sang that. Joey sang that particular song.
Gotcha.
Well, the funny part about our contracts, Red, is that if a promoter hired us back then, he would hire, it would say, Laredo / Reflections.
Gotcha.
So whatever, you know, we were. So that's what we were doing back then. And then we said, you know, this is crazy. We don't use Laredos hardly ever. Let's just, you know, keep Reflections, and which we did. And that happened after the exposure that we had from the PBS special.
Oh, which, by the way, you know, you guys did a fabulous job on the PBS special. I mean,
the band
was great, and, you know, you guys had a fabulous outing because, you know, some groups sound better than others on PBS.
Yeah. Well, the neatest thing about it was
the fact that we, being picked to do that, was kind of a privilege. We felt it was a big privilege.
Well, you guys deserved it and belonged there.
Well, thank you. And when we got down there, we were so impressed with the fact that, God, we're on the stage with people we grew up listening to that we never knew.
No, I hear you. Well, you know, T.J.
But I mean, it was a thrill for us.
T.J. and Henry did a great job.
Smart kid, though. Smart, yep. Good kid. I mean, the whole bunch of those people, they were always nice to us, treated us very well.
T.J. never knew the music that well, though.
No.
You know?
No, yeah.
But,
you know,
did he start a huge snowball rolling down a hill.
Didn't he ever. I mean, well, that was basically a real shot in the arm when he did that, because we were able to be hired outside of Detroit,
right,
as Reflections, because, hey, we're alive.
Right.
People didn't know we were alive. They thought we were dead.
I hear you. Let's talk a little bit about other Reflections groups that get confused with you, because I know there were a couple of them. There's an R&B group during the 70s.
Yeah, well, Melba Moore's background band was called the Reflections.
Uh-huh.
And make a long story short, what was really funny is we had done a thing called, I believe it's called a holiday in Canada. It's very much like the telethon that Jerry Lewis does here.
Gotcha.
Quite big. And we were there with Burton Cummings from the Guess Who.
Right.
And Burton wanted to meet us, and we didn't even know he knew us. Okay?
Right.
We were there, we sang a cappella. We sang live a cappella, and we did Still of the Night. We did a couple of things.
Gotcha.
Well, anyway, he comes down to our dressing room, and he says, did I ever tell you the story about our group? And I says, no, what? And he says, well, you know, we were called the Reflections.
Wow.
I said, what? He said, that's why we called ourselves the Guess Who.
Wow.
And I said, I had no idea. He said, when Romeo and Juliet came out and it became a hit, we couldn't use that name. We knew it.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, so he told us, and which is something I knew nothing about. You know, this is what I'm saying. The Internet, you would know immediately.
Right.
But not then. I mean, even though the Internet was there, not everybody had a computer. So what was funny about the whole thing was we had find out, we go on the Internet and find all these guys using the name Reflections. Now, right. We own the name. I mean, we actually own the name.
Right. And,
but, you know, I'm not in this to go suing somebody for using a name that they made popular in Tennessee. They don't sing our music.
I hear you. I
let them do their thing. Let them make money off of what they do. If they're going out and saying they're us, that's a different story.
No, I hear you. I hear you. Tony, tell me about the Reflections now. What are you guys doing now?
Oh, we're doing a lot. In fact, we're doing probably ever since the PBS special, we have been on the road more so than even I can look back. In the 60s, we did pretty big venues, but I'm going to honestly say I'm having more fun now than I did then, because I could say no if I don't want to go. Whereas, of course, you work for a record company, you have to go where they tell you to go.
Well, let me ask you this, too.
And literally make the money they want you to make.
If people are listening to this and they want to get a hold of the Reflections, how can they do that?
Okay, well, we have a website, reflections-music.com. You have a website there, you can get a hold of us through that. And there's a Gmail account there as well. If you want to find out anything about the group, and there's one of the guys in our group, Gary Banovitz, A-V-E-T-Z. Gary does all our booking for the group, and his number is area code 248-442-2344.
That's great. Is there anything that you would like to say to fans of the Reflections over the years?
Well, we appreciate every fan that we've ever met and ever come across, because I've heard so many great stories about Romeo and Juliet. you know, how it impacted their lives, and if certainly it's impacted ours. But I can honestly say that the fun part about being on the road now is hearing these stories, because back in the old days, we never got the chance to listen to a fan. They were usually screaming so loud that, screaming, crying, and fainting, that we never had any rapport with them other than to visually see them from the stage and never hear from them. Other than, you know, they love you, they want this, they want that, but it's basically that was the fan of years ago. Where today, we find the impact that Romeo had on the fans that we had from that era. And it's really neat to hear that.
Right, and you guys, you do a fabulous job on stage. I mean, the harmonies are crisp and clear. And the one thing that I marveled at is that everything I've heard that you guys have done is so beautifully produced. I mean, you know, you guys have gotten great production over the years, and the musicians behind you on every tune are top notch. Because I know about production. I mean, you know, I've done my own.
Yeah.
And every Reflections record is just crystal clear production. And I'm just wondering how you managed to do that.
Well, we're fortunate. There's a lot of talent in Detroit. And our band that was with us for many, many years, they're retired now. They retired and we have a new band now. But our old band were a mix of kids that kind of grew up with us from the 70s. And these are kids that learned our music. They were younger than us, not all of them. The sax player was from our era. He was older.
Right.
And the sax player was fantastic. Bobby Garcia was his name. And Bobby was on that Daddy's Home.
I got you.
On Daddy's Home. He's fantastic.
Daddy's home. Daddy's home to stay.
How I've waited for this moment to be by your side. Teardrops in your eyes.
Daddy's home. Daddy's home to stay. It was on a Sunday.
Monday and Tuesday went.
On a Tuesday afternoon,
all I could do was cry.
But I made a promise that you'll pray.
Oh,
I need it back home to you. How I've waited for this moment.
Teardrops in your eyes.
Daddy's home. Daddy's home to stay. Hey.
Your best friend Rotten told me
you had teardrops in your eye. Daddy's home. Daddy's home to stay.
Spider, and Spider played piano. And we also had a piano player with us before Spider that his brother's Jack White.
Uh-huh.
White Stripes.
Uh-huh.
Joe Gillis. And anyway, we had a lot of talented people in Detroit that are easily found in half the bars that are playing nights. In bars, you'll find quality musicians around town and singers around town. And it's sad that Motown forgot Motown.
Yeah, I know.
They moved out to California and they completely left.
They did. They cut a lot of people loose.
Oh, and it's sad because, the talent's still here. Usually blue-collar towns always create better quality talent.
I hear you. Because they're hungry.
Not only hungry, they want to leave.
Yeah.
They want to go where the glitz and glamour is. So they put more emphasis in what they're doing.
Yeah.
So I think that's a big thing. I mean, the amazing part, I'll tell you just a little story about one thing, getting back to our fans, and this really floored me. When in the 60s, we, of course, after the shows on Dick Clark tour, we would meet people and we would take pictures with them and that. And I remember meeting this woman. She wanted me to, she had, real long, it was in Texas, and she had, and she was called, I can't remember, they called her Belle or,
okay.
I can't remember, it was in, mm-hmm. in Texas, and she was some kind of, phrase that they use for her, and she was a real pretty woman, and she took a picture with me, and she said, and she kind of staged the picture where she sat on one knee and with her arm around my head, and she pointed her thumb up like that, and she smiled. Well, we took that picture years ago, and here we went back into Texas. This is maybe last year or a year before. Go back into Texas, and this young girl comes up to me, and she says, "Can I take a picture with you?" And I said, "Sure." So she says, "Do you mind if I stage it?" And I says, "I don't know. What do you mean by staging it? You know, you don't know today what kids are thinking." So she staged it. She sat on my lap. She put her arm around my head and put her thumb up. And I had no idea what the heck she was doing. They took the picture. Then after that, she took out a snapshot
of me and her mom.
Oh, man.
let me tell you that put me.
Well, Tony, great having you as a friend, man. I really cherish this time that we've spent together. You know, I wish the Reflections just all the best of the new year. When you guys get to Florida again, Paulette and I will absolutely come out and see you. It's just been my pleasure talking to you. I learned a lot that I didn't know about the Reflections.
Well, I really appreciate being even asked. That, you know, we have a lot of people in the Florida area that are from Michigan, too, and a lot of them from New York. And what's nice about that is I get to talk to them, I get to see them, and I want to say I'm really privileged to be in the situation that I'm in, and I really appreciate the fact that we have fans that come out and see us.
That's wonderful. It's been great talking to you, man. I'll see you soon.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
He took 100 pounds of clay, and then he said, "Hey, listen, I'm gonna fix this world today, because I know what's missing." And he rolled his big sleeves up, and the brand new world began. He created woman and lots of loving.
Magic moment, why your lips are close to mine, will last forever, forever to the end of time. Whoa, whoa.
I wanna go back to the good old days, missing the 50s again. I get a miss in the 50s.
There ain't no